Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer, I'll first be talking with Aurelio O'Brien. He's the author of the novel Eve, which is a satiric take on a genetically engineered and robotic future. Then I'll be telling you about a conference that's coming up in the spring that I'm helping to organize about human enhancement and human rights. And then I'll read a little snippet of an essay by a Southern Baptist theologian about the concept of cognitive enhancement. So stay tuned for all of that. I'm speaking with Aurelio O'Brien. He's the author of a novel called Eve. It's a novel about a genetically engineered and robotic future, a science fiction novel with a lot of ideas percolating in it. Aurelio worked in animated feature films for over 20 years as a designer, animator, and story artist, and he has a very colorful website at evethenovel.com, which has a number of the creatures that he describes in the book with the animation of those creatures. So welcome, Aurelio.
Well, thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Yeah, the web art was what I think first attracted me to the website. I think it was blogged on Boing Boing or someplace and led me there. And you did all that animation yourself, right?
Yes, I was trying to find an interesting way to introduce my novel for no money. So I used the skills I had at hand. It's difficult when you self-publish to get the word out about your book, so I thought if I did something eye-catching and entertaining, you know, my book might get noticed, and Boing Boing was a big help. You know.
When I saw the animation, I actually thought that this was going to be a website that was, you know, critical. It was kind of like a tongue-in-cheek anti-genetic engineering website, because you have things like the Laza Mopso, which is a dog that's genetically engineered to sweep floors, and the Dust Buster ostrich and things like that. And it just seems like the you know, extreme version of what Greenpeace lies awake imagining is going to happen in the future. You know, the animals are going to be redesigned for all these human domestic purposes.
Well, I decided to take kind of a humorous slant on it. You know, I think that humor is a healthy way to disarm controversial topics, and you know, if people can laugh at the sillier aspects of what genetic engineering might hold in store, I just think it'll be easier for them to deal with the realities of it. And my hope with Eve was that, you know, people would read it and look at the website, and you know, after when they stopped laughing, they would kind of think, oh, well, yeah, you know, how would we deal with this or that, or what would it be like if we could, you know, manipulate life into whatever form we choose.
Without giving too much of the book away, describe your protagonists, Eve and the speaker, the robotic protagonist.
Well, it's interesting. I started the book in third person, and then as I continued to write, the robot, Pincer, I decided to make him my first person storyteller. And what was kind of fun about that is that you know, Pincer is a robot, and a lot of science fiction deals with robots as kind of these soulless creatures that, you know, they are, you know, kind of stereotypically analytical and unfeeling. But I didn't want Pincer to be that, so I wrote him as a completely conscious, kind of self-aware being, you know, but I wanted to explore the idea that he wasn't really like us in certain ways. And my conceit with him was, you know, he only feels in an abstract sense of feeling, not in the visceral way that we do, so his feelings relate more to events or input. He kind of feels about things rather than actually feels things. Like he doesn't really grasp pain or fear or love. It's sort of like Plato's allegory of the cave. You know, Pincer only sees the shapes of these concepts, but he can't directly experience them. So I thought that would be kind of fun to have him tell a love story between my other main characters, Govel and Eve, and he doesn't really realize he's telling this love story. He kind of thinks he's telling his own story. So it's sort of fun for the reader in that way, because you kind of can read between the lines and you know that what Pincer's saying, he's not really getting it.
That's so, that's a very clever device to describe situations from that kind of Martian landed perspective, and then you have to interpolate backward to what's actually happening from a human perspective.
Yeah, well, he was fun in a lot of ways because I think, you know, the whole idea of artificial intelligence is so fascinating to me. And, you know, if we get to the point where a machine is actually a thinking, living entity, you know, this idea is, you know, that, I mean, they may indeed end up smarter than us. And when with Pencer, I mean, he was definitely, I tried to write him smarter than me. And believe me, that was hard to write. I mean, a character that knows a lot more than I do. You should try that sometime. It's like, it's really tricky. I mean, I was thankful for the internet and, you know, Google search engines and things like that because, you know, it's a whole different world.
How much are you trying to, with this novel, actually describe the future that you imagine, and how much were you trying to do a satiric take on the future? Because you have a lot of satiric and humorous elements in the story, but were you actually trying to describe the kinds of genetic engineering and artificial intelligence that you think will, you know, come soon?
Well, I grew up in the 50s and 60s where, you know, the future was this kind of, oh boy, here comes the future kind of attitude, you know, with the space race and lunar landing and Tang and space food sticks and when chemicals were good for you and all that kind of stuff. And I was sort of nostalgic for that feeling. And, you know, a lot of current future science fiction genre is dominated by that sort of dark, nihilistic, Blade Runner-y, Matrix-y, you know, everybody runs around dressed in black, and we're all doomed. And there's so much fear of genetic engineering that I didn't want Eve to be, oh, God, here come the horrible mutants. You know, I wanted it to be like, ooh, cool, I want one of those lick-and-spans. So that was kind of my approach to it. And I also find it just very fascinating. I mean, the idea was kind of born out of when Dolly the cloned sheep was cloned, and, you know, now we've mapped the human genome, and, you know, they're mixing fish genes into tomatoes and all sorts of stuff like that. And I just thought, yeah, wow, this is, like, amazing. And, you know, where is this all going to go? And being kind of a humorist in a sense, my mind always goes to this kind of funny place. So,
well, you have these creatures which, you know, on the face of it might gross people out or might seem grotesque. But as you point out, I think that, you know, a lot of the things that we are doing today, we get used to pretty quickly. The notion of organ transplantation, in vitro fertilization, we all get used to these ideas pretty quickly. So the idea of an organic plate and a dishwasher, the lick-and-span, isn't actually that difficult an idea to wrap your mind around, I think, once you once you had it in your house.
Right. Well, absolutely. I think we only have to look at things like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, like when she wrote that, the idea of harvesting and transplanting organs was, you know, really creepy horror fodder when she wrote it. And now it's considered, you know, downright noble. I mean, people carry, you know, donate your organ cards proudly in their wallets. And I always thought they should call those Igor Club cards. But now, you know, we don't think twice about that. And, you know, I guess it's kind of weird that we edit or change our perceptions that way, but we do that all the time.
The life forms that you describe in this book, like the lick-and-span, they're all patented corporate commodities.
Yeah.
And, you know, to what extent are you critical of that direction? I mean, there was recently the announcement that 20% of the genes in the human body are genetically, are patented. So, and we've patented many, many life forms. So do you think we should be going in that direction, or are you critical of that?
Well, I took sort of a satirical view of that because, you know, having worked in the media a lot and things like that, I think that whole end of things, you know, ends up getting kind of bizarre at times. But it was also an easy way within the text of my book to differentiate between something that was created and something that was like our genetics or random, so that you have the creatures that were made to be recycled, you know, all have their little trademark symbol or their little registration symbol, you know, that says that they can be recycled. So when you're reading the text, you can see that right away. You know, whenever the little copyright shows up, that okay, that's a creature that's been manufactured. And then also, I think that at some point, you know, it's going to come down to that decision of, well, you know, what life is sacred and what life isn't. And, you know, that's a topic a lot of people don't want to really go to because it becomes arbitrary. I mean, it is kind of always a big arbitrary you know, decision. But, you know, we eat animals, and, you know, a lot of people don't like that. And we're already, like you say, we're already manipulating things around, and a lot of people don't like that either. So I think that for me personally, I just look at it all and think it's all kind of amazing and really don't have any real answers to it. But I think that it's certainly something that we need to do a lot of talking about.
Your story is a pretty classic Pygmalion tale because Eve is a creation of one of the story's actors. Tell us how Eve comes about and what her purpose is.
Well, I created Eve to be simply the average normal woman, or, you know, the proverbial girl next door. And, you know, she isn't perfect. Well, like in the classic Pygmalion, he's trying to make the perfect woman. In my story, the twist on it is he's trying to make the imperfect woman. You know, he doesn't want the perfect woman. He wants somebody normal. And that's exactly what Eve is. But, you know, it kind of comes down to, well, you know, what the hell is perfection?
Because all the humans at that time are genetically tweaked out in various ways.
Well, the randoms in my story are basically like us, except they're all the genes for death or aging have been undone somehow. So they all just kind of live forever. But they're all called randoms because they still contain a lot of random genetics. And so Eve is sort of made to be like that. But, you know, she doesn't really end up average or normal because, you know, what is average or normal? You know, we're all different. So I was kind of playing with a lot of those themes of, you know, perfection and being average and all that kind of thing. And in hopes of getting people to kind of think about that, is that, well, what is the perfect person, or what is the perfect animal, or what is the perfect pet? You know, it's different things to different people. And I think that, you know, one of the things with, as we have, as a society, have more power over those choices, you know, what kind of choices are we going to make? And I guess that's where I wanted to go with this book, was just thinking about those choices and, you know, what bizarre things will we choose to do? I think that, you know, it's the idea that, you know, people freak out about all this genetic manipulation until somebody does something, you know, really cute, like they'll develop an apricot poodle that smells like apricot jam or something, and then all of a sudden it'll become a big fad, and, you know, then everybody's like, oh, great, you know, let's get genetically altered pets. And I really think that that's inevitable.
I'm speaking with Aurelio O'Brien. He's the author of a novel called Eve, which you can find on the web at evethenovel.com. And he has a lot of very interesting graphics that he designed himself. Little animated shorts of depictions of the various creatures that he describes in the novel. So it's a very humorous website. I recommend that you take a look at it. Now, in the book, you do, as you said, you describe various notions of genetic perfection. Are you worried of humans? Are you worried that we're moving in a eugenic direction, or that, you know, that eugenics is necessarily a problem? Or do you think that human beings having this kind of control over our own genetics is an inevitable and desirable thing?
Well, you know, that we do have control over it, or that we're gaining control over it, is inevitable. And I think that that's the part that a lot of people don't want to face. And, you know, when we get into the aspects of morality and religion and things like that, people don't want to go there because, you know, that's always been kind of God's realm before, or, you know, it's been kind of out of our grasp before. But it is in our grasp, and we are going to have to make those decisions. I think that we'll do what we always do, is we'll kind of muddle through. You know, we'll make some bad decisions, and we'll make some good decisions, but, you know, we'll basically muddle through. In my book is kind of how I approach mankind. You know, there's a lot of really beautiful things in the world, and a lot of really goofy things, and some really strange things, and some kind of stupid things. But, you know, that's the world, you know, and it's not going to change just because now we can manipulate genetics.
What was the initial inspiration for Eve?
Well, you know, part of it was the scene that they were able to clone Dolly, and all of a sudden it dawned on me, you know, wow, that's all going to happen. But another was I was thinking, okay, well, you know, we get to the point where we can do all this genetic modification, you know, where's mankind going to go with that? And, you know, people to me are goofy. I mean, you know, we use supercomputers to make animated cartoons, and people out here in California drive around in Hummers as commuter cars and think actors should lead governments, and, you know, we're kind of simultaneously clever and idiotic. And I was thinking, well, you know, where would we take all this stuff? And then I had just read an article that stated, you know, our primary use for home computers by the general public is to peruse porno and to play computer games. And I just cracked up, and I thought, well, there's where we would go, you know. We'll use that technology, you know, for sex and amusement. And, you know, that kind of made me think of this sort of world where basically everybody has their own little genetically designed Disneyland. And that was kind of the birth of the idea for the world. And then I thought the twist on the Pygmalion story would tie really nicely into that.
I think one of the most dystopian notions that people have come up with about a genetic playground is precisely the one that you just touched on and that your story kind of touches on, which is that people, men in particular, might use this technology to create sex toys, sentient, animate sex toys. You know, that you kind of dance around that with Eve as a real person with a personality of her own and no compromised individuality. But, you know, you have these creatures who, you know, you could imagine tweaking out a dog or a cat so that they would be a functional sex toy. Mm-hmm. Would you think that that would begin to push your limits of tolerance of the kinds of future and the kinds of genetic tweaking that you think would be acceptable?
Well, you know, it's funny because it's like the idea of living forever, which I personally find kind of humorous. I mean, there's people right now, actual medical scientist type people, who are calling aging a disease, and I'm sorry, but I find that really funny. And with all the talk about undoing the aging process and with genetic manipulation or hormone treatments or stem cell injections or whatever, I have yet to hear a single person bring up the fact that if we find a way to extend life indefinitely, we have to stop making babies. And, you know, in my book, I make fun of that in a way. And my society, you know, they undo death, and then they kind of go, oh, yeah, I guess, And then they quickly create sterilization day as an afterthought. And then, you know, if you don't have sex being defined as procreation, then, you know, it has to be channeled somewhere else. And so, you know, I kind of play with that in the book. And those sort of ideas are things that, you know, eventually we're going to have to face.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, just from a kind of political economy point of view, it seems like the birth rate's naturally falling and we could sustain a kind of very slow birth rate with radical longevity. But that's a conversation for another time. Mm-hmm. So are you working on something else now? Have you got more projects in the works?
Well, I do have a book I'm working on that is not directly related to Eve, and then I have an idea for a sequel to Eve or a follow-up to Eve. If people find the book interesting enough, I'll gladly go back to that world. It was a lot of fun to write. So.
Uh-huh. How's the feedback been so far?
It's been pretty good. I've met some interesting people through the internet, and you know, recently got contacted regarding some interest in the film world as well. So.
Well, that's kind of natural. I mean, your book does seem to kind of suggest itself as a screenplay, so.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. That would be really great.
Well, I've been speaking with Aurelio O'Brien. He's the author of the novel Eve, and you can find that at evethenovel.com. Thanks so much for joining us, Aurelio.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I wanted to invite all you change surfers out there to a conference that I'm organizing as in my capacity as the director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. It's a conference at Stanford University Law School on May 26th through 28th, and it's a conference called Human Enhancement Technologies and Human Rights. We'll be joined by at least two other co-sponsors, the Center for Cognitive Liberty and Ethics and the Stanford Center for Law and the Biosciences. This is the conference call and a call for proposals for people who want to speak at the conference, which, of course, you're also welcome to propose to do. But here's the conference call. Much of the criticism of enhancement technologies has focused on the potential for increased discrimination against women, people of color, the poor, the differently enabled or unenhanced humans. Some bioethicists have proposed a global treaty to ban enhancement technologies as crimes against humanity. Defenders of enhancement argue that the use of biotechnologies is a fundamental human right, inseparable from the defense of bodily autonomy, reproductive freedom, free expression, and cognitive liberty. While acknowledging real risks from genetic, prosthetic, and cognitive enhancement, defenders of enhancement believe that bans on the consensual use of new technologies would be an even greater threat to human rights. Healthcare, disability, and reproductive rights activists have argued that access to technology empowers full and equal participation in society. On the same grounds, a generalized right to technological empowerment might connect defenders of enhancement technologies with disability activists, reproductive rights activists with would-be parents seeking fertility treatments, the transgendered with aesthetic body modifiers, drug policy reformers, and anti-aging researchers with advocates for dignity in dying. Yet, what, if any, limits should be considered to human enhancement? On what grounds can citizens be prevented from modifying their own genes or brains? How far should reproductive rights be extended? Might enhancement reduce the diversity of humanity in the name of optimal health? Or conversely, might enhancements inspire such an unprecedented diversity of human beings that they strain the limits of liberal tolerance and social solidarity? Can we exercise full freedom of thought if we can't exercise control over our own brains using safe, available technologies? Can we ensure that enhancement technologies are safe and equitably distributed? When are regulatory efforts simply covert, illiberal value judgments? Between the ideological extremes of absolute prohibition and total laissez-faire that dominate the public discussions of human enhancement, there are many competing agendas, hopes, and fears. How can the language of human rights guide us in framing the critical issues? How will enhancement technologies transform the demands we make of human rights? With the Human Enhancement and Human Rights Conference, we seek to begin a conversation with the human rights community, bioethicists, legal scholars, and political activists about the relationship of human enhancement technologies to human rights, cognitive liberty, and bodily autonomy. It's time to begin the defense of human rights in the era of human enhancement. Again, that's a conference that we're going to have in Stanford University Law School, May 26 to 28, 2006, organized by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, which I direct, and the Center for Cognitive Liberty and Ethics and the Stanford Center for Law and Biosciences, and we're seeking other co-sponsors for that meeting. You can find that conference call and description of the conference and ways to register eventually at ieet.org. To close, I want to read a little bit of an essay that Al Mohler, the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, wrote last week called Radical Enhancement and the Denial of Human Dignity. I mean, sometimes when I'm talking to people, they don't really think that there's anybody out there who's actually as concerned about these issues as I am. This is an example of someone who is concerned about them, and he actually runs the largest Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And he's quoting here from Arnold Kling, who blogs at the Tech Central Station, a conservative blog site. At any rate, radical enhancement and denial of human dignity. Should human beings accept certain limitations in terms of cognitive ability and physical strength? These questions take on a whole new urgency in the face of recent developments in the field of psychostimulants and other pharmaceutical innovations. Moreover, as if these developments do not represent enough of a challenge, the development of computer-enhanced human intelligence may be just around the corner. Arnold Kling, author of Learning Economics, introduces the issue in a most unusual way. Perhaps, he says, the last unenhanced human to make a significant contribution in the field of mathematics has already been born. In 20 years, the tenure track at top university mathematics departments may consist entirely of people who depend on drugs, direct neural computer connections, genetic modification, or a combination of all three in order to achieve high-level performance. Kling points to the mathematics department because the use of psychostimulants among some mathematicians has now become public knowledge. As far back as two decades ago, mathematician Paul Erdos was offered $500 to see if he could kick his use of Benzedrine for just 1 month. As Joshua Four noted in Slate magazine, Erdos met the challenge, but his productivity plummeted so drastically that he decided to go back on the drug. Kling reports that an increasing number of college students are using Adderall, a drug commonly prescribed for students diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. According to Kling, there are students who have never been diagnosed as having attention deficit who nonetheless claim that the drug improves their concentration. When I asked my college-age daughters if they knew many students who take the drug, they each responded, "Of course." Depressives have Prozac, worrywarts have Valium, gym rats have steroids, and overachievers have Adderall, quips for. Some call Adderall a cognitive steroid because it appears to have the same effect on consciousness and alertness that anabolic steroids have on muscle performance. Four describes Adderall as a cocktail of amphetamines that increase mental alertness, concentration, and processing speed, and decreases fatigue. Who doesn't need a little help in those categories? The diagnosis of attention deficit syndrome has its own troubled history, but the use of drugs like Ritalin and Adderall has become widespread among the young. Four cites one study indicating that as many as one in five college students takes either Adderall or Ritalin as study buddies. Later on, he says, beyond this, genetic modification will be another path for temptation. Perhaps scientists can find a way to modify genes and enough of my brain cells to improve my memory or other cognitive skills, Kling observes. If not, then they are likely to develop the ability to enable parents to determine genetic characteristics of children. If nothing else, they will be able to give parents of babies fertilized in vitro the ability to select based on genetic characteristics. All this runs counter to biblical understanding of humanity. According to the Bible, human beings are inherently finite. All humans bear the image of God, and this sets humanity apart from all other creatures. Nevertheless, the Bible warns that human overreaching is, at least in one sense, the very essence of sin itself. This is true of Adam and Eve in the garden when they ate the forbidden fruit, and it was the driving energy behind the organizers of Babel who wanted to make a name for themselves. There are limits to human intelligence, and a Christian view of humanity cannot encourage the use of artificial means in order to transcend human limitations. Unfortunately, there is a fine line between efforts to achieve health and ambition to transcend natural human limitations. Now is the time for serious-minded Christians to give attention to these questions and to confront these present and future challenges with mature Christian reflection and genuine biblical engagement. We bear responsibility to think about these issues before the brave new world of human enhancement arrives in its more radical forms. Otherwise, the needed debate will come too late. And that's an essay called Radical Enhancement and the Denial of Human Dignity at the website crosswalk.com, which is a part of R. Albert Mohler's ministry. He's the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the Aimphos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.